The date is Sunday, January 26, 2003, Toronto to Manhattan, and this is Bob talking with Tao. Here he is.
Good afternoon.
Hey, Tao.
Hey, how are you?
It's Bob.
Bob, nice to speak with you.
Yeah, I'm okay.
You're good?
Yeah. Oh. Are you?
I'm feeling good.
You're feeling the pleasure of being human.
Yeah, I suppose.
In your body, in your veins.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Are you?
Yep.
Good. I was just kind of getting a little bit of a crash course with Matt about what this project's about, and
What did he do for you?
What did he do? He actually just played a few of the introductions to his radio show that broadcasts tonight.
Introductions of what?
Poetry.
What's the
content? Poetry. Some poetry.
Oh, sound bites.
Yeah, sound bites. Yeah. So did that, and then just spoke to. Then he was just telling me that he's met you a few times and how you met and just how what a great character you are. So he's also collecting some of your essays. Are you working on any right now?
Yeah, we there's some up. There's another one that's unfolding, which I'm pretty well finished, but Matt hasn't had the time to put it up yet. But that's
okay.
The next thing coming up.
What are you working on with that? What is the thrust of that essay?
I'm laying out the five school.
The
four
five.
Plus five. Fifth is a different phenomenon, but say four schools of influence due to McLuhan.
Four schools.
See, he, what's called the Toronto School of Communication, mm-hmm. was based in Toronto.
Right.
Then came the New York School. We'll call it the different schools of media ecology. So they have the Toronto School of Media Ecology centered around his son and Barrington Nevitt.
Yeah.
And this surfaces after McLuhan dies in 1980. Then there's another school of media ecology in New York City, and that was known as Semiotext, put out by Silvera Latrunje of Columbia University. And it was the book series that introduced a lot of the postmodern people like Baudrillard, Virilio, Deleuze and Guattari, Foucault, to general university culture, intellectual culture in the States.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the second school that McLuhan had influence on. The third school was around Arthur Croker's journal. He and David Cook had a academic journal called the Canadian Journal of Political and Social Theory, I think it is. And I call that the Montreal School of Media Ecology. And then there is the fourth school, which is the diasporic school. You know the word diaspora?
Yes.
Diaspora?
Yes.
Yeah, so the scattered people influenced by McLuhan, I call the diasporic, and some of them actually took over McLuhan's coach house at the U of T, but they weren't really part of the Barrington Nevitt, Eric McLuhan.
Yeah, they're kind of separate, aren't they?
Beg your pardon?
They're kind of separate, aren't they?
Do you know of them?
Yeah, well, I attended U of T for 2 years, and I'm actually going back in September and want to do some more studies of semiotics, actually, but I wanted to look into the McLuhan school at U of T, too.
Right. And so that's Derek DeKirchhoff and others, Bob Logan, and I lay out the biases of each one of these schools, and they are the ones that are more literary-oriented, book-oriented, and keeping the old 19th-century tradition of humanism going, and they have a problem with McLuhan's more postmodern aspects, which are developed in the New York school. So you have the diasporic school, the fourth school, and that includes people like Neil Postman in New York and others around the world who have established a bit of identity for themselves, all influenced by McLuhan and carrying on or trying to correct McLuhan's work. And then the fifth phenomenon, because those first four were all in the 80s that took off after McLuhan died, and the fifth phenomenon is the McLuhan revival in the 90s,
mm-hmm.
which was spearheaded in popular media by Wired magazine.
Yes. Yeah.
And it gave it reinvigorated the previous four schools.
Right.
Eric McLuhan got book contracts. Barrington Nevitt got his books out. Frank Zingroni got some books out. The Semiotext series, the people they made famous, became even bigger and more academically acceptable in the 90s, and therefore they had to respond to the McLuhan revival, because as people got to know their works, they saw they were influenced by McLuhan. So that's Baudrillard and Virilio. Semiotext itself went off into just publishing fiction, but I would still consider that part of McLuhan's work, because McLuhan wrote fiction, basically a new kind of science fiction.
Right.
So that's still within McLuhan's vortex. And then Postman and them got a lot of book contracts. De Kirchhoff got a few books out in the 90s, all within the revival of McLuhan. And then within this fifth school, or this we'll call it the fifth element, the fifth phenomenon, which recycled the four schools, I was featured by Nelson Thal. And actually, I was the beginning. What Nelson Thal and Dave Neufeld, mainly Dave Neufeld's very good musical computer work, what they created in the albums in 92, which I had nothing to do with, but they used my material from the radio show, spearheaded the McLuhan revival, in a sense anticipated it, because it came out a year before Wired magazine did.
Right.
So you have these five phenomena. You have the four traditional schools.
And then this one.
They are recycling in the media and in enlargement in the 90s. And then you have the sixth school, which is the Para McLuhan School.
Mm-hmm.
Focus around Don Thiel and myself, and you're talking to it and being part of it right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But if you want to get degrees, you which is a dangerously irrelevant activity today.
Yeah, I know. I'm
very
with you,
dangerous.
I'm not really going for a degree.
You really are?
I'm not really going for a degree.
Oh, that's wise. Yeah, just go for a break.
No, it's yeah.
And then you can you can have more slack in that situation, and you would therefore you can don't have to just limit yourself to the Toronto the diasporic school there at the U of T. You can include your interaction with the sixth school, which is me.
Yeah, that's part of it too. Well, everything I consider everything an interaction of my experience, right? So
well, that's obvious. So you're not saying anything there, right?
Well,
unless it's in relation to other statements, which are even more obvious and stupider.
Oh, okay. Well,
no, really, take that statement. What you define, obviously certain words in there mean something to you more than other words, but to hear from someone else hears it, what you said is like saying, yeah, it's cold out today.
Yeah, it's very simple, but I'm not familiar with how obvious things are to you, so...
Right, so you said that, and then that seemed obvious to me. Now, you can claim that your stuff is not so obvious. That's okay.
Right. Oh, are there things that you're going to be saying that are less obvious to me?
Yes.
Okay, good.
That's guaranteed.
Okay, good. Well,
let's just say the words I use will evoke an image that's less obvious.
Okay.
It's a contention of the words, since we're limited to the word and the phone here.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain media bias here.
Mm-hmm.
If I was there in person, there'd be other effects of what I said, which might enhance or even obscure more of the obviousness.
Mm-hmm.
See, so within this situation, we're sort of basically focusing on English language, and there's a lot of words and a lot of depth in the words, which requires the hallucination. It is hallucinatory.
Yes.
Our interaction with each other.
Yes, I can understand where you're coming from with that. But
right, I in a sense that whatever thinking or taking in information is like eating. The outputs are never the same as the inputs.
Right.
So what I say to you will be altered by you, just as what you say to me will be altered by me. If we want to come to a closer matching of seeing the same thing, then that's what we're attempting in this dialogue.
Yeah, I don't know what your attempt is in this dialogue, because I'm aware that I can have no control over what anything I'm going to say to you, what effect anything I say to you will have. I can only have a control over what I am trying to mean and what I determine to be mean, the meaning of what you're saying to me.
Right. You have control over how I interpret you in your terms.
No, I don't have control over that, though.
Yes, because when I interpret it and say something back, then you can correct it.
Only to a certain extent, though, because we could go on forever, and maybe in that my meaning actually changes, too.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So, yes, we will never meet. You know, our consciousness will never come together, but paradoxically, we're the same consciousness.
We are the same consciousness. So this is just a nice interaction that I was planning on having with you, and I don't know what you're wanting to get out of this conversation or why you're having it with me.
I'm creating these dialogues to put on our website so that people can see what an amazing communicator I am and how easy, nice, and friendly and challenging, so that other people can hear them, and then they'll say, I want to talk to that guy, and then I'll charge them.
You'll charge them? Okay, that's
so you're getting into the ground floor.
I see. Okay, can I invest?
Yeah, it'll be a good investment.
Or is this my investment?
No. You need to invest using the money medium, yes.
Oh, the money medium.
If you want to.
I see, okay.
But the thing is people don't know how to talk. Let's say they are too skilled anymore in having extended, attentive conversations.
No, I can see that. I mean, I experience that on a regular basis, but I've been kind of paying some attention to that lately, too.
And right, so I'm trying to give examples of that.
Okay, so you...
So that's what I'm doing.
You're giving an example of being a conscientious communicator?
Yes, and not just to get agreement, but to show the value and the fun and the sex of abstract,
did
interactive,
you say the
whatever you want to call the speech effect.
Did you say the sex of what?
Yeah, it's sexy.
It is sexy, okay. I didn't know if you said sex or effects.
No, sex, yeah.
And
in a sense, it's titillating or it's pleasurable.
Uh-huh. Okay, and...
We're rubbing up against each other inside the telephone medium.
Mm-hmm. And there's something else you just triggered in me.
Want me to say the sentence again?
Effective communication. Thank you. And you were talking about the difference between us communicating over the phone as in person. Do you feel that I've read something lately saying that actual our verbal communication might only be 10-20% of our actual communication when we interact with people?
Yeah, that's always been the case, but then we could refine that observation. When two people met, you know, in the woods 10,000 years ago, they may have spoke the same language, but let's assume they did. But remember, that's just verbality. They would smell each other, they would look at their clothes, and all those signs would have some associations which were significant. So obviously body language and clothing language are part of communication. It's not just speech.
Right.
What was interesting is that people started studying speech per se, verbal speech, in the 20th century. It's called linguistics.
Yes.
And at the turn of the century, McLuhan said, well, if we're starting to focus on verbal language and written language, that is sort of obvious now, so maybe something shifted. So he saw that that the new languages, the new clothing people were wearing, were the electric environments, like the telephone, the radio, movies, cars, television. So he said, oh, these are what people are really communicating with and within, and therefore the fetishistic response of academia to looking at older environments, whereas looking at those older environments weren't too obvious 400, 500, 700 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
People lived within writing and speech, and they were the new invisible environments.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they may not have been as literately verbal as we were, because they hadn't even got the printing press sometime before the 1600s.
Right.
So now, when people communicate, because their bodies, the old body language communication is only one part of themselves, since they have much of their life in the discarnate or disembodied state of things like cell phones and modern digital media, the images and effects those languages create on people are what is taken into account when two people interact. So it's their interior mental landscapes. So right now we're talking, and you're gauging me, and I'm gauging you, so I'm wondering, does he watch The Simpsons? I'm not necessarily wondering this, but as examples of people today, you assess what programming they've taken in through other media, other languages, rather than just the body, clothing, and verbal abilities.
Okay, so...
So that I've expanded on your statement. It's certainly, the verbality is maybe only 10%, 5% now.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I'm with you. So you're talking mainly about the interaction between two people? Is that what your pursuit of study is?
Right now, in these conversations. Yeah, I'm isolating the two people talking, mm-hmm. using a very small part of their being, speech, developing the speech, but using it to point to the other languages and clothes they wear. So it's, I'm not doing this as a nostalgia for speech. I'm just using speech to point to a lot of things beyond speech. All
right? Right. That sounds interesting. Okay. So,
but that requires this form, speech interaction, is the best way to pay attention to the other things. One of the better ways. Or it's an impoverished way. Like we said earlier, people can't sustain attention too much with speech. Now, I'm now explaining why they can't. It's not their fault. They have too many other signals they're processing between people. Mm-hmm. Political correctness came out of that. The group mind comes out of that, you know, 25 years ago. Because when you start interacting with bodies, you're looking at a moire. Do you know what a moire is?
No, I haven't heard of that.
M-O-I-R-E. It's a superimposition of images on top of other images.
Right.
Sort of like a visual, I would say visual pun, but overlaying mm-hmm. of images, which people can experience when they take drugs.
Right.
Certain kinds of drugs, you can see the x-ray of layering. So the moire that we are now, mm-hmm. not just our physical body, but the other TV body,
yes.
the chip body, and the astral body, mm-hmm. the spiritual body, all that make up
the astral body is the spiritual body?
Yeah, that's a term for other things that are not just physical. It may mean you live after death. It may mean you live before death, but I'm including those,
and the
realities.
Are the chip body and the TV body, are they a part of the physical world?
Yes,
okay.
we have new. The physical body is basically what I call the neuron body, which is the chemistry and biology you're taught in science and the drug companies exploit.
Right.
That's a certain Western 19th century technological artifact, image of a body. Because our actual bodies are a mystery. They're made up of so many things that we don't fully understand.
Right.
So when I say physical, I'm actually referring to the neuron body.
Mm-hmm.
I make that distinction. And then I'm now saying I've laid out the four bodies, but they all come together to make up your real body, which you could call the physical, but it's made up of all these factors, which the word physics doesn't include. So I call it the mystery body. So we're two mystery bodies talking through... limited fragmented media, telephone and speech.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really limited, but why not surf it, use it as a pleasure.
Yeah, so yeah, because what's the limit really? What would you consider as the limit of this medium and what you'd really like to be getting at? I don't know, I'm trying to get at, I suppose, a limit restricts you from activity that you'd like to be having? So
No, I don't want to always be using all my faculties in relation to someone else, so it's good to fragment the faculties, like reading a book by the person or doing a telephone.
Right.
Because when you're in person with people, there's so many interactions, so many distractions, which is okay when you're in the mood.
Right.
But here we're trying to be scientists or artists or playwrights or technicians. We're trying to develop our attention to what we are.
Right.
In a quiet spot.
Yes. Beautiful. A contemplative state.
We're trying to be Tao.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
in one aspect. It's like a hologram.
Yeah.
One aspect does as much as swallowing the whole as any other. So speech and telephone do as much to swallow the mystery body as any other form of communication. The mystery body, though, is like not a hologram, a macro image. It's anamorphic, which means it's like a black hole that you can't see all the dimensions of, and everything is being swept into it, but they're expelled back out again, and those parts that are expelled back out or reflecting before they go into the black hole are equally representative of the situation.
And they don't... Yeah, and
so it's half fractal.
Hasn't physics actually said that things seem like they're coming out faster than they went in?
Yeah.
When they come out of a black hole?
You asked me if I said that?
No, isn't that what science is finding?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
You will always find that any images that become memes, cultural shared disciplines or repositories of imagery, they always reflect what's actually going on in the mystery body,
mm-hmm.
which is all the factors involved.
Well, this is the inner and the outer life, right? The inner body, understanding ourself, right?
Well, when you say the inner and outer body, that's the inner and outer of the neuron body, the inner and outer of the TV body, and the inner outer of the chip body. There's six inner outers.
But you'd also agree that at the same time, there's no real inner and outer.
There is an inner and outer, but the imagery we use to represent it is really deficient.
Is it? Oh, okay. So there isn't a paradox in the inner and the outer itself.
There is, but it's three paradoxes.
Okay, three paradoxes.
Yeah, three pairs of paradoxes, because you got the TV paradox, the chip paradox, the astral paradox, and then we'll make it four if we include the neurons.
So
four paradoxes to make up the mystery body.
Okay.
And we're separating out the paradox because these are four different realities, environments, weathers, that we have to use different imagery to express.
For the purposes to understand it.
Yeah.
That's just kind of like the normal scientific model is breaking something down to understand it, right?
Yeah, I don't mean understanding that way. I mean to loosen up what demands our attention, because most of what demands our attention does not admit that they're a fragment. They say, here's what you need to know. You got to know this.
Right.
And it's so limited. And you got all this stuff coming at you. And if you get a flexibility, you develop a yoga mm-hmm. in relation to these hypocritical demands, then you should have more autonomy and more pleasure, in a full sense of the word pleasure.
Right. So is there something you're looking to know?
Let's say this. Everybody might watch the news to see what's going to happen in Iraq or whatever is going to happen to them.
Right.
I say that if you pay attention to the news, you'll be less informed. Or if you respond to any of the media that tell you what's going on, you'll be less informed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my answer to what you just queried.
Okay. Okay. So.
And they're not necessary to pay attention to.
Right. But aside from those things, okay, what do you pay attention to?
The news.
The news.
and so I'm using the word differently here.
Right.
In the sense, I pay attention to what is given to me by my associates, and I also assume that I have ESP. I know I have ESP, and I'm picking up on all the other bodies and their vortexes of information. I know I am, because those things are inside me,
right.
Not just me, but everybody. So we are communicating among ourselves so tightly,
yeah.
so resonantly,
mm-hmm.
that I know that most of what comes through the major media will reflect me.
Right. Yeah.
You've had that experience.
That's exactly it. Pardon?
Yeah, you've had that experience.
Yes. I actually feel that this conversation is a reflection of me.
Yes.
Right, so
it's very hard to separate out of this what I call cloned ESP that we have technologically, linguistically created. And our personal mystery bodies are very similar to the social mystery body, and within this cloned ESP, it's very hard to actually to separate yourself out of it. So I assume there's only one person talking, communicating right now.
Mm-hmm.
All of us.
Right.
That's what's really interesting.
The one.
Yeah, and I don't mean a mystical one. I mean technologically. I call it Rumpelstiltskin.
Oh, okay.
We have hijacked ourselves with this oneness, and it therefore our natural doubleness is confused.
So, what conundrum does that create in your life, though? Like, how does this affect your life and living it?
It doesn't affect my living it very much.
When you say hijacked and those kind of things, those words connote
victimhood.
Yeah.
Yeah. But because I know that what my speech is pointing to is quite illusory and not really affecting me, then I have to say that it doesn't affect me.
Okay.
It doesn't victimize me. I just know when it's cold out,
yes,
I know how to deal with it.
Right.
I got some other media to put on.
Right. Right. So
some clothes. So it's a flexibility of using our clothing around us.
Right.
I still have to deal with the...
And you learn to use that clothing. You've learned to use that clothing just to use it in the most enjoyable way in your life.
Yeah.
Good.
So, you know, I know where to take it off and put it on. So I'm putting on a certain kind of clothes talking to you,
mm-hmm.
certain kind of clothing, and I know that is very puny compared to a lot of the other clothes I'll have to wear throughout the rest of the day. I don't mean to put it down as puny, but it's very tiny. But if I really enjoy the clothing as we're doing it, it can become very powerful. Very, what I call holeopathic. It's homeopathic. It is stronger the more diluted it is. So this private little conversation we're having
mm-hmm.
is so puny compared to the millions of messages and data that's swirling around all of us and everybody else that we might as well consider it invisible. But we know from homeopathy, the more that something dilutes, it's more powerful. So we may be having a very powerful, like the chaos's image of the butterfly,
mm-hmm.
the butterfly's wings affecting huge storms, we may have a big effect here.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think
part.
We can measure whether we did or not, but we have to assume we are having a big effect.
Well, I consider my approach mostly, and my attention is on this more often lately, that there's an equal... I have to approach it as if the situation is equally and give no measure, really, to this being any more puny than any other encounter I'll have today.
Right. Now, the interesting thing is that we've created a technology that's come alive and has its own life independent of us. I call that the Android meme. It
what
is
do you call
having
that, sorry? Sorry.
An
Bob?
Equal force, equal
Bob?
Power.
Sorry, what do you call that?
The Android meme, M-E-M-E.
Okay.
All the ESP that humans have has been simulated
right.
by our present vortex. So I see that as coming alive, and it totally knows that what it does is as important as anything else. So we have a double of ourselves to contend with. So as you become aware of as you've just expressed, the importance of what you're doing, you reconsider it as equally important as anything else. Remember, that's being simulated and echoed and bypassed by another that has the same awareness. That's not human.
Mm-hmm.
That's the science fiction reality that McLuhan was pointing to.
Okay, so then what effect does that have on my life?
Ah, that's where you got to learn how to pay attention to the different clothes, because then you might think it is bothering you and it isn't. Or you might think you're free of it and not be aware it is bothering you. This could lead to disease, could lead to unhappiness or lack of pleasure.
Right.
So we do need, humans always need to understand and discriminate what's happening around them. That's what we, our senses and minds are for.
Right.
We filter, but that's important to filter.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an immunity system.
Yes. And, okay.
So I'm trying to enhance my immunity by enhancing yours.
I see. Okay. That makes sense. And then the goal is perfect health?
No, the goal is to remain in the game.
In the game.
Which means enjoy, more enjoyment.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel that you have the ability to, in knowing this and strengthening this immune system, do you have the ability to create your reality?
Yeah.
Right.
That, and I know the Android meme is creating its reality. And it likes
to
pretend that I'm in it.
Is that so? The Android meme that you speak of, this is another fragmentation for greater understanding, or is it autonomous, or is it complementary? I just want to understand the relationship between you and me and my Android meme and you and yours.
Right. First of all, you know how as you're talking, there's a part of your mind, soul, consciousness, whatever it is there, that's aware of what it's doing. Very subtle doubleness there, right?
That is aware of what it's doing.
Yes.
Yes.
And looking at it.
Yes.
All right? We'll call it the subtle doubleness.
Okay.
We have made our technology so subtle, our digital media, that it is getting that close to us. Now, what I just described in you...
This is in the outer world. Like, just you're talking about planet Earth, year 2003. Our technology is getting that close to subtle doubleness. subtle doubleness?
Yes.
Okay, okay.
And now,
so,
if we
so
look
it's getting
at that
close
stuff,
to its own consciousness of itself, too, just as we are of ours.
Right.
Okay.
And now, I bring this up because is that subtle doubleness, would you call that complementary, paradoxical, those terms you said 2 minutes ago?
Would I consider complementary paradoxical?
The subtle doubleness that's in you and me.
Yes.
Would we apply the terms you said about 2 minutes ago in your question and statement to this subtle doubleness? Is this doubleness paradoxical? Is it complementary? Which are two different meanings.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, whatever we decide that is, and then I'm claiming the Android meme is miming that, then I would have to say it's paradoxical and it's complementary.
Yes. Yeah, I see both.
Right.
My answer would have been both to that question.
Right. So that's my answer to your question about my relationship to the Android meme.
Okay.
Now, it does it itself. Mm-hmm. So if there's two double subtlenesses, that's four, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I get the term quadrophenia.
Mm.
We are interacting with a quadrophenic, not a schizophrenic situation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's really interesting because...
And you... This awareness, obviously, you bring to... every interaction relationship you have, right?
Only if I am spoken to.
Oh, this doesn't relate to things where you're in your own, in the presence of no one else, or in the presence of animals or anything else?
No, I could even be on the subway. I can be in presence with others. I don't talk about it unless I'm spoken to. And if I'm spoken to, I don't necessarily bring it up, but then the engagement, the idea, the theme is there floating around. But I don't think about it too much when I'm just functioning as in the neuron body, what appears to be the neuron body,
okay.
Like walking down the street.
Right.
I know if someone... wants to interact with me, I then bring in the quadrophenic aspects that I'm talking to someone who has other bodies, and so do I. So if you look at the traditional Zen literature,
mm-hmm.
The Zen Buddhists would look at any student that came and say, okay, here's someone pretending they're not enlightened.
Right.
Remember that story?
Yes.
Okay. Now we have to look at technology and look at others as people who, not stupid, but the same theme. They are pretending to ignore their other bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a new kind of technological Zen attitude I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
So
when someone comes to me and they pretend they're stupid in spiritual, religious Zen terms, I know that that's not just the subterfuge that the Zen master recognizes. I know that's just one quarter of the subterfuges. There's three other subterfuges. The person is pretending they're not aware that they have a TV body or in a screen body.
Mm. So those, okay.
So we got to be a little more updated in our Zen Buddhism teaching.
For the now.
Of the Tao and of the now. Yeah.
And this only engages when you interact with someone else?
Right, because the mystery body situation is that we're only one thing now. So there is nobody else.
Right.
Only when someone shows up and interacts with me, then all the implications of the oneness becomes biased in the fragmentary quadrophenia.
Okay.
Now, when I'm by myself, there's only this one body around us.
Right.
It's not limited to me, you know?
Right.
So we have reached an interesting point of silence in human evolution.
yeah.
Therefore, much noise to distract, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But in that... So how do you talk to yourself?
That's no problem. That goes on its own. In other words, when I'm by myself in a crowd, not talking, mm-hmm. I am communicating by my clothes,
yeah.
But people aren't as affected by clothing as they were 100 years ago because... physical neuron body clothes, the pants and shoes, are so puny compared to other factors in people's profile that etiquette between people has to take into fact. So that's why people can wear anything they want now, right? Men without hats.
Right, men without hats.
Just think of it, you know. big deal to wear no hats in the 70s, whereas, you know, you look at movies, 40s and 50s, 30s, people wore hats, right?
But
clothing was
those
so...
Those are puny, but do they still have...
Judgment? Social judgment and etiquette? Yeah.
No, not just that, but they still have... they're a text to themselves, too.
Right.
And that can be read. It's just like the difference between a glaring billboard and maybe a small piece of newsprint that's...
Yeah, they're glaring... we're all glaring billboards, and you know, you get on a bus, you experience a lot in New York here. People are keep to themselves, or on the subways, they don't talk, and some people might say, well, it's very unfriendly, very cold.
Mm-hmm.
No, you're being misled. These people are processing the other bodies, not just the neuron body that's sitting there in the subway, mm-hmm. and they're assessing other people's emanations and ESP in that, and that requires silence.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas silence, you know, 100 years ago would be socially awkward.
Right.
You know, you had to address the other person. You just have to think of old movies, our Akashic Records, showing people in the 19th century, they get on a train, they sit in a car, they'll make a big deal of the guy sitting across from the woman or something, right?
Right.
These old-fashioned movies. That is, actually, to talk to the woman today or to the man today would have the opposite effect. You'd appear violent.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
So a lot of the neuron body has been shifted aside, put aside on the shelf. So in the silence, everybody's processing stuff. Their other bodies are processing away what they watch, what they observe, and whether Rush Limbaugh was correct. I don't know who you have in Toronto, well, Peter Zosky. He's gone, right?
He's gone.
But anyway, someone like that, or TV news, or Saddam Hussein, or genetic engineering, they're all processing these images.
Right.
So actually, we've put our citizens in this electronic digital age into great meditative monastic states of being. And this is not talked about by our useless politicians, in the sense that the people who pretend to have power have no power and no involvement. We actually are glad they'll do the janitorial work of keeping the old institutions going while we continue to meditate.
Yes.
And process.
Meditate.
You walk by the bank, you know, the transparent windows, there's lots of people at their computers doing their accounting, but they ain't just living there. And they're not just thinking there. That's why people want jobs. That's why everybody, women's lib happened in the 60s. They says, man, I can't stay in this little suburban house. It's too limited. It's too confining. I got to use my other body. So they ran out under the guise of women's liberation just so they could sit somewhere else, get paid, and meditate on all the other images that came through their other bodies. Now, I just described what's going on. Yet the public language about what's been going on is so inadequate. Now, that's not important, because we're meditating past it anyways. But if someone asks me what's going on, I'll say, this is what's going on. And
right.
They hadn't heard that before.
So, if more people had your understanding, what would that mean to you?
It wouldn't mean a thing. Because it's the who's the you you're referring to. If you're talking about Bob the neuron body, that's only one-fifth of us.
Right.
The understanding that... that I have, I think a lot of people have too, because they've been conditioned to have it. We live in the highest decibels of consciousness that any human culture ever had. So it's not important. There's no me to respond to your question, so to speak.
Okay.
But we can exchange in a, I don't want to say it's a cynical game, but in a pleasurable use of my mouth, with your mouth and ear, we're doing a tiny little activity.
Right. Are you enjoying it?
Of course.
Oh, I'm good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. No, I don't get too bothered by things.
No, neither do I.
But I'm in a society that allows me to indulge in that. Now, if I was starving in the outskirts of Sao Paulo in Brazil or someplace,
yes,
I'd be in a different situation, right?
Definitely.
I might be enjoying it in that context, though, if I was... born under a good sign, born
yeah.
under a bad sign, different astrological situation, I might be uptight today.
Right. But the fact is, you are what you are.
Right.
That's your experience, that's your choice.
Yeah, you ever look, no matter where kids are, they play.
Yes.
They have the joy of being human.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Of the pleasure of existence. So that's really what's always going on here.
Right. So you're just creating more enjoyment for yourself?
I resist being pinned down.
Pardon?
I'm resisting being pinned down.
Oh, sorry. No. I don't mean to be pinning you down. No.
I know, but, you know, if someone asks me to pass the butter, on the surface, I don't go into what constituents is in the butter. I just pass it.
Right.
So when you ask me a question, I can take the surface level or I can go into a real depth.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Imagine me interrupting, this butter, you know, if you look at the box, all these pesticides and thing in there.
Yeah.
The person says, well, I don't mind that. I says, okay. So and then I decide at that moment whether I want to push it or not.
Right. Well, in that case, though, you'd be exercising your freedom to pass, to go into more detail about what the butter's about.
Right.
When the person's just asked you to pass it.
That's right.
And then taking into consideration the Zen analogy you said earlier, you'd have to assume they're pretending not to.
Yeah.
Pretending about their own enlightenment, right? Because maybe they know about what's in the butter.
That's right. And they're testing me.
Right. That's the nice part about everything. See, I find that just everything's so fulfilling when you approach it from that point of view.
Yeah, the details, the subtleties between people are very, I want to say time-wasting, are a great way to pass, to expend your energy. Because that's what you, every day you got energy, and how are you going to spend it?
Right.
And,
I've thought about that before, too, because if we are infinite, then there's no real spending of energy.
Right.
It's just our own awareness of our energy.
Right, but remember I said we all have filters. This is the human condition. Apparently when we're dead and looking at all our lives, which are all going on at the same time in the Akashic records of your soul, and other souls, Akashic records, it's very hard for the soul consciousness to decide what to do next, what to focus on. So it creates a little problem.
Uh-huh.
It creates the task of expending, limiting the infinite energy. So a reincarnation creates a little problem.
Right.
You see, even though we have infinite energy, we like to filter. So here we like to create a small limitation. And there's the attempt of deluding ourselves, which the Zen guy deals with. How much are you going to make out of the problem that you need while you wait for Godot? Godot.
Yes, yeah.
Instead of Godot.
Godot, yeah.
Godot. I just read a very interesting thing about that, just a digression here, pass it on for the record. Hugh Kenner, a Canadian critic influenced by McLuhan, was a friend of Samuel Beckett. And you know the play Waiting for Godot?
Yes.
What Beckett did, he was in World War II, he was in the resistance, and you never could know more than one person above you and one person below you, because if you got caught, you didn't want to have to give away too many names.
Right.
So your knowledge of who you're dealing with was limited, and so you'd be told to go wait for somebody for the next resistance action in Paris or wherever, and you wouldn't know who you were waiting for. You might have a name, you wouldn't know if the name was the real person's name or what.
Right.
Just a code word, right?
Right.
Now, as you're sitting in the cafe waiting for someone that you are instructed to meet and you don't know, people are walking by you carrying furniture.
Mm-hmm.
And you know why they're carrying furniture? Because the Nazis all of a sudden could decide, we want to use this person's house for some other thing, and they'll kick the person out of the house.
Right.
So in the play Waiting for Godot, you have these people, these couple of guys sitting around waiting for Godot, who they don't know who he is.
Right.
Once you understand it's an espionage situation.
Right.
And you have people walking by with furniture. It is a literal, the play is a literal replay of life in Paris in the early 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Yet everybody projects all this other stuff in there, which is okay, but it's very interesting to know how Beckett they asked him to be creative, write a play. So he took went out the street and tape recorded some people talking, and then he came in and wrote it down, typed it out, and then made a crazy story about it and altered it up and said, this is what I imagined. I created this.
Right. But that's the beauty of life, is always that meaning, right? I mean, sure, this is that taking
meaning? Did you use the word meaning?
Putting the context, putting that in a different context where people are looking at it in an artistic fashion and choosing to critique it and all of that, and looking for the deeper, so-called deeper meaning.
For the roots of it or something.
Or
yeah,
the roots of it.
They're presented something out of context.
Add God to the equation.
Beg your pardon?
And then they add God. Like,
yes, right, the God. The G-O-D.
The G-O-D.
Yeah, that's the trick.
Yeah.
But
here it is, like, yeah.
God it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you could say it, God-ot.
Yeah.
Go dot. Now, remember, Beckett was very involved with James Joyce, his secretary for a while and everything, and so he's really influenced by Joyce, and Joyce has, at the end of Ulysses, a big dot.
Does he?
Yeah, it's not a period, it's just a big dot that sticks out of half the page.
And what do you consider the significance of that?
Well, that's the go dot.
Go dot.
That Beckett, the disciple of Joyce, uses.
Right.
So he was continuing writing Joyce's Ulysses in theatrical form.
Hmm.
Anyway, that's just a side thing. But meaning, you know, there's a dangerous word because it's a literate word, refers to maybe data that you can see and read.
Mm-hmm.
We live so much in invisible stuff now that meaning of meaning can't be used anymore, or it's very limited. So how can we find what the word meaning used to refer to today?
Right.
I guess I've been describing it for the last half hour.
Right.
How to find meaning, but I wouldn't use that word.
Okay.
I'd call it memeing. The Android memeing.
Right. Why? But you are creating a new. You are conveying a new meaning to this term I haven't heard before called Android meme.
Yes.
Right. So, you feel that the word meaning is out of date?
The way people use it and what they associate with it is out of date.
Okay.
Because meaning for literate society is some narrative that leads to a point, a conclusion.
Uh-huh.
That can be applied in passing the butter or passing over and dying. And
right.
What is the meaning of dying?
Right.
And we have a whole Christian, used to have a Christian context for that
right.
in the West. So there's some associations for meaning. Those associations don't apply to the multiple bodies anymore.
Well, most of language wouldn't then.
Right, that's right.
So
I mean, speech is so. I mean, even T.S. Eliot at the turn of the century writes a poem saying, "I've got to use words when I talk to you."
Yes.
Even he knew that the radio environment, the electric environment, was a whole new language that made verbal speech quite awkward.
Yes. So, why is Android meme any less awkward?
Oh, the word is nothing. It's two little syllables, right?
Right.
I've used it on chat lines and that, and people say, "Well, this is a syllogism. This is that." They knock it, and they don't realize. I totally agree that Android meme, three syllables. What the hell is that going to do? Nothing.
Right.
You know.
Right.
But I got to use the alphabet when I'm in those media.
Right. Got to use what we have, and
I do spend a lot of time enlarging. If given the opportunity, what I'm pointing to by those three syllables.
Right.
Which is, nowhere near. You just looked at Matt show you my chart. If you look at the chart, very big, meaningless bunch of shit, but it's in order.
Right.
That's a picture of the Android meme.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen.
Yeah, he'll show
Matt,
it to you.
Matt has a chart? Yeah, okay. I'll look at that.
So
yes.
Here we are
using
words, very limited vocabulary. I threw a couple of new words in there. You're referring to a few words you have. You see how tiny this experience is?
I seriously, when you measure it that way, I see it as just as vast. Oh.
It is vast. Are you there?
Yes, sorry, there was an interruption in the line.
See, I use one word, and then I got to immediately cancel it.
Yeah.
I said tiny. I said, over here. He came over, and then I said, no, that's not where we should go. Let's go back over there. And you helped me go back over there by objecting to what I said.
Well, exactly. And the same thing, I am realizing that there's no point in me objecting to it, because tiny is just as insignificant as huge, right?
Right. So when something... really. Irrelevant as speech, you can make a lot of money out of it, because when it works, when it's economically viable, it's really useless. And so that's why we have the incessant talk shows. and people making millions being talk show people.
Okay, let's
because
let's,
speech is no beauty.
Then let's talk about that then too. Then the economy. How does economics factor into you wanting the exchange of money and that meaning? The meaning of what is money to you?
What you mean me setting up these dialogues to make money?
Yes.
Because money
is about clothes again?
Beg your pardon?
Is it about the clothing again?
It's about survival. You see, what we have here is money is the Android meme.
Oh. Money is the Android meme.
Right. And money is not a bunch of bills, though that's one form of it.
So I see
money
that.
Today is an orbital economy that's a bunch of digital interfaces that's taking place nowhere.
Right.
Right?
Right.
That huge economy, and that can't crash.
Right.
So it saves us from the old 1929 depression.
It can't or can?
It cannot crash.
No? Okay.
The
economy cannot crash.
No.
Why is that?
Well, you remember in 87 when the computers did their Paris Commune and went on strike?
Mm-hmm.
The Wall Street guy says, this is wrong. Let's just break the rules and stop the computers. They stopped the game.
Right.
Right?
And they stopped by stopping.
That was illegal. They stopped the trading. Otherwise, it would have just been down to zero. You're not allowed to stop the trading.
Right.
But they stopped it.
As long as the trading keeps going, nothing will crash.
Even, you can turn it off. It's
okay.
It's not connected to humans. It's just that the humans interpret it going against what humans thought trade was for, which was survival. We can stop it.
Right.
And therefore, that would seem that, we master it. It's not distracted from us. But what they did is they stopped it, and then they started up again. And it carries on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, isn't that an example of...
Okay, so that's the Android meme.
The myth of survival,
thing.
Though, too.
It's got me hijacked at that point.
It's got you hijacked at that point. Well...
Not in speech, not in normal freedom of choices of expression. It is hijacked my nervous system, my food.
Right.
This is the crisis.
And you're trying... Are you there?
Yes.
Sorry. And you're trying to... just master that.
I'm trying to survive.
Survive, but survival is an illusion too, right?
Right. And you didn't ask me who I was when I said I'm trying to survive. You should say, is that the chip body speaking, Bob, or the neuron body, or the astral body, or the...
Oh, I'm just talking to you as a whole body.
Ah, yes, but that whole body, you're not going to hear much from.
Oh.
Because it communicates. Around, not through speech.
Right. So
it's too puny.
So you'd be answering that as the physical body trying to survive.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that was one-fifth of me saying, because I need to survive.
Right. Okay.
But the chip body, he hasn't spoken yet. It hasn't spoken to that question.
Yes, excellent.
It may have. Maybe we had the first time the chip body said, I'm trying to survive, but you didn't ask for the clarification.
Right.
It's like I go to a medium. I have a very good medium I go to when it makes a prediction.
Yeah.
And then later I come back and it didn't happen. They say you didn't ask the percentage of our accuracy, which you must always do.
Oh.
If they make a prediction, I say, what is the percentage of accuracy? They'll go 65%.
Right.
Or they might say 90%.
Right.
So that's the part of paying attention, which means you can't ever assume what's
going
on.
No, you can't
on.
Assume.
This usefulness
are
of
you
thinking.
Are you aware when what body is speaking?
When. I'm talking to who?
Anytime. Are you always conscious of
body
is speaking?
I know. That's why I say we're all one. One body, because the chip body, the Android meme body, including the TV, any, whatever term, this thing we're in, is always talking. That's all I'm talking to. That's all I'm talking to. That's why I don't have to talk to humans, or why I can remain in silence, because I know they're processing the same body, and we're all the same person.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing.
Just processing it.
So the Android meme wants to survive, not me. It is forcing the money situation. Right?
Okay.
Did I leap too fast? Want to go back four sentences?
No.
Okay, good.
I'm just going to let that marinate.
Good.
I actually have to go now.
Okay, so what time is it? We did almost an hour. That's pretty good.
Yes, I think we did.
No, it was a very good discussion.
Oh, thank you for speaking with me. And,
no, thank you.
No. Thank you.
And who is saying that to me? Your Taos chip body, Durham body, or what? Which body?
All of me.
Oh, the mystery body.
No.
In other words, you're saying it to yourself.
Exactly. Who are you? I'm just thanking it all.
You're just thanking it all?
Yes.
Yeah, you should. You're still alive. You're still experiencing. That's good.
I'm still sorry?
You're still experiencing as of 3:30.
Yeah.
January 26th, you are still here, still conscious. That's good.
Yeah, I don't know if there'll be a point when I'm not. I'm actually pretty sure there won't be.
Yeah, that's right, because if you weren't conscious, you wouldn't know it.
Exactly.
You will not know it, so that's yeah. And so, yeah, you've died three times, maybe, so to speak, today. You don't know if you've died, but you can assume that...
On every breath, Bob, on every breath.
Yeah, you're still going.
So I have to go. Matt's back here.
All right, so I'll probably talk. Are you going to walk out right now?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great meeting you, Tao.
You too.
I always just ask a couple details. Were you born in Toronto?
North of the city.
And how long have you been working there in Toronto?
I've been living in Toronto since I was 18, so about 6 years.
Right. Okay, great talking to you.
You too.